The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I just wanted to thank everyone on behalf of the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law for showing up and coming out. We're excited about this panel, Human Rights in the Workplace, Employment Discrimination Based on Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. As you can see, we have pizza that is here, and anyone can grab a slice if they want. But as we get started, also we have food outside, which apparently on your way out, if you want to grab some of that, you can grab some of that. I've been talking to the people. So before we kick it off, I just want to kind of give the pitch for various other upcoming events. The first is that tomorrow we have Human Rights Defenders, a conversation with LGBTI advocates from El Salvador. That's tomorrow. These are a group of people who are speaking from El Salvador, obviously, and they're speaking before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights about LGBTI issues in El Salvador. And they're coming here, and we're definitely looking forward to it. Also tomorrow, and I don't have a flyer for it, but we have our Cool Human Rights Work I did over the summer event, in which grad students who are doing Cool Human Rights Work are coming out and not only explaining what they were doing over the summer, but also explaining how they got into it, what contacts it can make to get further into human rights work. Also, on Tuesday, we have the third of our Munching on Human Rights series, which I know plenty of you have probably been to. It's good because you get free food. And it's really for people who are looking for an introduction to human rights issues. On Tuesday, on November 12th, it'll be with Professor Diane Ornlicker, and it'll be an introduction to criminal law. Diane Ornlicker was the former deputy for war crimes issues at the Department of State, and she's the United Nations independent expert on combating impunity. So she's like definitely the person that you want to be hearing from if you're interested in these issues. We got a lot coming up. So on Thursday, November 7th, we have a conversation with Dr. Watt, who is a Vietnamese. He was a former political prisoner in Vietnam, who's coming here and is speaking. It's an event that's open to all law students. Although it's the Speak Truth to Power, which is a program through the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Center. People will be there, but it's open to all law students. And finally, on November 14th, sorry to be whipping through these, but we have the Human Rights Implications of Psychiatric Diagnosis with a whole panel of experts. And that will be held on the 14th in the JD Lounge. We got all the flyers that are up there, so please take the flyers on your way out if you haven't gotten one already, and come out to the event. So I'm going to turn it over to the panel. First of all, I want to thank, obviously, Paul, who put this whole thing together and has done all the grunt work, and the center is really, really thankful for everything that he's done. Hadar is very thankful for everything you've done, and I'm very thankful for everything you've done. So thank you very much for putting this together. I also want to thank Preston Mitchum, who is a WCL alumnus.
I love you, Preston!
Our very own alumnus. For agreeing to moderate this discussion with Brian Moulton of the Human Rights Campaign, Daniel Vail, who is Acting Assistant General of the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and Ian Thompson of the ACLU. So thank you very much for being here, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. So welcome to the Human Rights in the Workplace Employment Discrimination Based on Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity event. First, I want to thank you all for even joining us. I know the room is really full and jam-packed, but take time out of your busy schedules to come, and we really appreciate that. So we're hoping that this event will continue the much-needed conversation surrounding human rights and really LGBT equality, not only in the workplace, but really abroad and outside of the workplace as well. My name is Preston Mitchum, and I have the privilege of working as a policy analyst with the Center for American Progress. Specifically, I work with the FIDER Initiative, which is the Fighting Injustice Through Equality Initiative. We work at the intersection of sexual orientation, gender identity, race, economics, and poverty. And a lot of the work I do is surrounded around eliminating and dismantling what is social, economics, and health disparities faced by LGBT people of color. So in addition to that, I also work on workplace discrimination issues through Center for American Progress's Workplace Discrimination Series. It's a video series where we highlight LGBT workers who have been discriminated against for employment discrimination, which is really about not being promoted, being fired, or not being hired based on solely identifying as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. As a May 2012 LLM and Law and Government graduate here, I'm indebted to the Washington College of Law and would like to thank the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law for even inviting me to serve as a moderator. Not only am I anxious to hear about workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity and expression, I'm also enthused to be surrounded by an embarrassment of riches that make up this wonderful panel. And the panel is a group of advocates, professors, lawyers, and lobbyists, of which I'm happy to join the fight for LGBT rights. So last March, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon stated, "Some say that sexual orientation and gender identity are sensitive issues. I understand. But I learned to speak out because lives are at stake, and because it is our duty to protect the rights of everyone, everywhere. It is with this same vigor that makes me excited to hear this robust discussion and learn together about workplace discrimination and human rights in the workplace, because lives are indeed at stake. Deeply entrenched homophobic, biphobic, and transphobic attitudes, often coupled with the lack of legal protections against discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation and gender identity, expose many LGBT people to egregious violations of their human rights. Everyone, regardless of their sexual orientation and gender identity, are entitled to enjoy these protections. One of those protections is the ultimate right to be free from discrimination and freedom of expression, and the right to enjoy your freedom of expression. This is a core legal obligation of states with respect to protecting human rights. Now, for my human rights gurus out there, the Yogyakarta Principles. The Yogyakarta Principles are the application on international human rights law in relation to sexual orientation and gender identity. And it's a set of principles relating to sexual orientation and gender identity that intends to apply equally throughout international law and human rights standards. Allowing for employment discrimination to continue against one of our nation's most vulnerable populations, theoretically and pragmatically, violates these important principles that set our standard for how LGBT people are treated. But yet, even with these obligations and principles that set our human rights stage, we have a great issue here, and one that is very troubling. That issue is workplace discrimination against the LGBT community. A discrimination so severe that it made it difficult for LGBT workers to financially provide for themselves and their families. It isn't a secret that our nation's capital has been a state of gridlock, driven by grandstanding and political ideologies. What may be a surprise, however, is that members of Congress from both sides of the aisle agree with each other and with the American people on one thing, the importance of the American dream. And keeping with that dream within country's workers. And when political gridlock stands in the way of human rights, we have a problem that must be addressed through legislation, public policy principles, and on-the-ground grassroots advocacy. So this past summer, the Movement Advancement Project, HRC, and the Center for American Progress released a comprehensive new report called A Broken Bargain, which looked at the myriad hardships facing LGBT workers across the country. One of the initial findings from this report unearths the unique demographics and characteristics of LGBT workers in the United States. For example, the report found that LGBT workers are racially and ethnically diverse. One in three LGBT respondents, that's 33%, in the 2012 Gallup poll identified as people of color compared to 27% of non-LGBT individuals. Also, LGBT workers are geographically dispersed. As many as 4.3 million LGBT people live in states with no laws providing employment protections based on sexual orientation and gender identity and expression. LGBT workers in the United States are also at a higher risk of poverty than other workers, so please don't believe the media when they say we're all rich, middle-class, white men, because that's not true. So, among the hardest hit by the broken bargain for LGBT workers are those who are parents together with children. And a special note is the number one state with lesbians raising children is Mississippi, and that's something that most people probably are very surprised by. Currently, there is no federal law prohibiting discrimination in a private workforce on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. And because of that, LGBT individuals frequently experience a 1-2-3 punch. That is, discrimination in employment, fewer benefits, and higher taxes based solely on being LGBT. So I'll go through a couple of workers who we highlighted in our workplace discrimination series at the Center for American Progress. So whether the worker is Ashlyn Johnson, who received a termination letter where she was in the ICU for over 7 days, or Kyler Broaddus, who faced harassment from his supervisors and coworkers, including offensive remarks, ostracism, unreasonable demands, and restrictions on his gender identity, like access to bathrooms, or Mia Macy, who was told that her job was no longer available as she was offered the position, her background check was completed and she uprooted her life from Phoenix to San Francisco. Or Sam Hall, who was subjected to physical and verbal harassment from colleagues in a mine that he was working in West Virginia. The purpose of INDA is to address the history and persistent widespread pattern of discrimination, including unconstitutional discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity by private sector employers and local, state, and federal government employers. So to give a slight overview, since I know we're going to discuss it a little bit more, I'll just say a few things. INDA is a federal bill that will prohibit workplace discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression. And it will make it illegal for employers to discriminate on the basis of hiring, firing, and not promoting solely on that basis. And it also only applies to private employers with 15 or more employees, which is something that's really important because that's something that a lot of people who are against it may not know or simply don't care about that caveat. And also, I'll just say, just something that I've also heard is INDA explicitly prohibits quotas, preferential treatments, and federal data collection. So the question some people may have for the panelists is, why hasn't INDA been passed yet? It's one I can't answer, so hopefully one of these three gentlemen can answer it. So that is a wonderful question, but Congress has failed to provide crucial protections for LGBT workers, which oftentimes places an insurmountable burden on the workers and their families. These unfortunate situations can leave an employee with two situations. One, they can put up with the discrimination and harassment, or they can leave their job and be financially insolvent to provide for themselves and their families. So I'll just say workplace discrimination is a real problem in our country, and it has real implications for what this means for LGBT people throughout our country and abroad. And so continue this conversation related to employment discrimination related to sexual orientation and gender identity. I'm happy to welcome Brian Moulton, Legal Director, Human Rights Campaign. Daniel Vail, Acting Assistant General Counsel, U.S. EEOC. Ian Thompson, Legislative Rep for the ACLU. He also works to advance the organization's civil rights and liberties issues in Congress and the executive branch by focusing on issues impacting the lives of LGBT people and those living with HIV and AIDS. Panelists will give the introductory remarks and discuss what their organizations are doing and any other pertinent organization related to the EEOC, LGBT discrimination, human rights, and INDA. Please give everyone a round of applause and thank you all for coming.
So I thought I would start off sort of giving you a brief overview of where the law is, sort of where how it evolved and where we currently are, and that'll sort of set the stage for my colleagues Brian and Ian to talk about sort of where we may be heading. But first of all, I just want to start off by asking a question. How many people in the audience here have taken an employment discrimination class or even an employment law class? Okay, so a few of you. Are you all law students here? Everyone in the audience. Okay. So you heard Preston say that there's no federal law prohibiting employment discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. And when I talk about this topic, I say that, but then I say, well, we have to sort of add an asterisk to that and or modify that sentence slightly, and I would put it as there's no federal law that explicitly prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. So as you probably can tell from the materials and from the introductions, I work at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That's the federal agency that's charged with combating workplace discrimination. We enforce the federal protections against employment discrimination. Of course, each of the various, well, not every state, but most states and localities have their own separate and distinct laws prohibiting employment discrimination. And there are many state and local agencies that do on the state and local level what the EEOC does on the federal level. But I, of course, am working on the national and federal level, so I'm concerned about what federal law prohibits. And the EEOC is charged under certain federal laws with doing a bunch of things. Interpreting those federal laws, sort of helping people who are subject to those laws and people whose rights are contained in those laws to understand what the laws say. So we do a lot of sort of policy guidance and regulations. We also enforce the law. So we are empowered to sue certain employers if they've run afoul of the law. That's sort of in the private sector. And in the federal sector, with respect to federal employees, like myself, the EEOC actually acts as an adjudicator. we have a federal tribunal and appeals process where we actually hear claims brought by federal employees who thinks that their who think that their rights under these federal statutes have been violated. So in these various capacities, the EEOC has worked to try and flesh out these statutes and breathe life into them and make them sort of real. And one of those laws is Title VII, right? Have you all heard of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 64? Is there anyone here who has not heard of Title VII? It's okay.
Yeah.
You have not? Okay. Well, there's this landmark Civil Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, one of the most important pieces of civil rights legislation ever passed in the country. And one piece, one subpart of that is Title VII, which prohibits employment discrimination with respect to all employers that have 15 or more employees. And it prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, and sex. That's the word in the statute. It says, no employer shall fail or refuse to hire, discharge, or otherwise discriminate with respect to compensation, terms, conditions, and employment because of such individuals' race, color, religion, national origin, or sex. Okay? Now, remember, this was passed in 1964. By the way, that Title VII also created the EEOC, which opened its doors in 1965. And so you can imagine this is quite a while ago. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary. Yeah?
You said that it prevents, like, if you have 15 or more employees, you can't discriminate. So if you have less, you can?
You can, unless you're an employer that operates in a jurisdiction that has a state or a local law that covers you, you know, covers 14 and fewer employees. And a lot of the state and local laws do cover those smaller employers. But yeah, there are some that aren't covered by these kind of prohibitions. So remember, this law was passed 50 years ago. And at that time, it wasn't really on the radar screen of the Congress in passing Title VII to be thinking about sexual orientation and gender identity. I think that's fair to say. And there's a real dearth of legislative history defining just what exactly Congress did have in mind when it put that word in the statute, sex, and what it did mean by discrimination on the basis of sex. So what you'll find is the very early cases that started interpreting that pretty universally concluded and pretty readily, quickly concluded that, well, whatever sex means, we know it doesn't mean those things. It doesn't mean sexual orientation or what they would often call sexual preference or gender identity, what was often called back then transsexualism or transvestitism or any number of other different terms that are now usually brought under the umbrella of gender identity. And what are some of the reasons you think that these courts came up with for why they said that the term sex doesn't include those other protected classes or individuals? Yeah.
Wasn't still at that time homosexuality considered a mental disease by the American Psychological Association? That would be something that they wouldn't see as a valid reasoning for, they would classify that under mental illness for just like being discharged from a job, not necessarily, you know, something that you know, personally born with.
So maybe thinking it's more like a behavior. Okay, anything else? Yeah.
Well, they might consider sex and gender to be two separate things because one's biological and one's social.
Yes, right on. That's like a lot of sort of the language you see in a lot of these early opinions. The courts say sex means, it means you can't discriminate against women because they're women or men because they're men. We're talking about a biological concept of sex, you know, kind of anatomy. What we traditionally think of as, you know, a man is a man, a woman is a woman. So, of course, back in the 60s, and it's actually, unfortunately, even still true today, there's widespread sex segregation in certain types of industries, in certain types of workplaces. And that's what, according to these courts, that's what Congress was getting at. Sex, not sort of, you know, social roles and gender norms. Yeah.
It's the same word. I think, why does Congress did not choose the word as gender?
Well, we don't know. We don't know because there's very little legislative history. The word sex was inserted kind of late in the debate, and so there's a lot of folks who have looked at that and have said, well, really, sex was inserted into the legislation to suggest that they wanted to kill the legislation because they were really concerned with the prohibition on race discrimination. And a lot of the Southern senators and congressmen thought, oh, if we put in a gender prohibition or a sex discrimination prohibition, nobody's going to vote for that, because of course, you know, most of the people in Congress at the time were men, and no way they're going to vote for that. Now that sort of view of the legislative history has kind of been revised over the years, and it's been discredited to a large degree. But the point is, there's very little legislative history, so we don't know why they chose the word sex specifically, except that, you know, it sort of seemed to fit kind of the common sense idea of what they were aiming to get at, which is discriminating against women because they're women and men because they're men. Okay, another thing that the courts want... Yeah?
I have a question. So this sex, the definition of sex, is based on the physical capability or assumption of sex. Mm-hmm. So if you have a male distinction of men and women, they have like better mentality or something, or is cover the meaning of sex-oriented, like is this sex cover the LGBT meaning?
Well, and that's sort of what we're talking about here, is did Congress have in mind at the time they used the word sex, could they possibly have thought that concept was expansive enough to include things like sexual orientation? And the early courts that interpreted the language said, no way, of course not. They meant it in the most traditional, limited understanding possible. And the courts also pointed to the fact that there had been numerous attempts over the years by Congress to amend the statute to add the words sexual orientation or sexual preference, and none of them had ever passed. And so, according to these courts, well, that couldn't have been what Congress had in mind at the time it actually inserted sex, because see, Congress is now trying to add different words, sexual orientation or sexual preference, so that couldn't be what sex actually meant. So what happened is, early on in the 70s, the law became calcified. It became obvious to all courts that Title VII didn't cover LGBT folks. At least it didn't cover discrimination based on LGBT status. And the law pretty much stayed stuck there for about 25 years or so. And then in 1989, there was a landmark Supreme Court decision called Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins. And in this Supreme Court decision, the court basically, for the first time, recognized that for purposes of Title VII, the concept of sex really does also encompass the notion of gender and sort of societal and cultural concepts related to gender. And the facts of Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins were, Ann Hopkins was someone who worked in an accounting firm, and by all accounts, she was an exceptional professional. She brought in a lot of business, she worked very, very hard, and she was up for promotion to partner. And the folks, mostly men, who were considering her candidacy for partnership, made a lot of comments while they were considering her, and they said things like, well, you know, she's really kind of masculine for a lady partner candidate. She really needs to take a course of charm school. Maybe she should do her hair differently. Maybe wear some makeup. Dress a little bit more femininely or walk a little bit more femininely. Then she'd be a little bit more appealing. So she didn't make partner. And she sued under Title VII, and she said, I wasn't picked because I'm a woman who basically didn't meet their stereotype, the people who were reviewing me, I didn't meet their stereotype of what they thought a woman should be. In other words, I transgressed their gender stereotypes, right? So here wasn't a classic case of where she wasn't a woman who wasn't being picked because she's a woman. The people who refused to promote her for partner, it wasn't just because she was a woman that they had a problem with her. It was because she was a woman who didn't meet their classic sort of view of how a woman should be. And the Supreme Court said, you know what? that's every bit as much a form of sex discrimination as some of the more traditional types of sex discrimination that we've long recognized. That's sort of gender stereotyping. And when we see those types of stereotypical comments creeping into employment decision making, then that's a violation of Title VII. So that was in 1989. And after that, a lot of courts started looking at this sort of legal theory called sex stereotyping or gender stereotyping to say, hey, well, wait a minute. If that's true, what about LGBT folks? Aren't there certain aspects or attributes of LGBT folks that could be seen as not adhering to traditional sex-based stereotypes? If you take the example of someone who's transgender, for example, they announce to their boss that they're going to transition from male to female, and they start presenting at work. If they were assigned the sex of male at birth and they start presenting at work as female, well, if a boss says, hey, you're a man, you should come to work dressed as a man, and instead this person comes and starts presenting as a female, and they're fired, aren't they being fired because they're transgressing the boss's gender stereotypes? So we started to see this theory being used in the courts, being brought by LGBT plaintiffs to break down that calcification in the law that had for decades said, no way, no how can LGBT plaintiffs ever bring successful claims under Title VII. And beginning in, it's interesting because I think most people would probably agree that the T part of LGBT probably in many ways is the least understood or traditionally has been sort of the most subject to myths and fears in some respects. But in terms of the legal evolution, courts have actually been more receptive in recognizing as cognizable claims under Title VII in the transgender realm. So starting in 2006, we see a bunch of courts of appeals that have said, hey, you know what? We're going to apply that Price Waterhouse Supreme Court case, and we are actually going to recognize under Title VII valid now claims brought by transgender individuals. So slowly but surely, the courts started to finally say, we're not going to allow any longer defendants or courts to say, just because you could call a protected trait something like transgender status, and those words aren't in the text of Title VII, we're not going to allow you to then say that's not covered under Title VII. Because if what's really going on is discrimination that's rooted in sex or gender stereotypes, then that's all the statute requires. That should be covered under the law. And so after a few courts of appeals had looked at this issue and found that that could be covered under Title VII, the EEOC, in one of its own decisions, remember I mentioned that the EEOC as an adjudicator with respect to federal employees sometimes issues decisions, it issued an appeal in 2012 in the case of Mia Macy versus the Department of Justice. It's something that Preston talked about. He mentioned Mia Macy. And this was a landmark decision in the federal sector because the EEOC for decades had held the way that every other court had held, that transgender folks could not bring Title VII claims, that they just weren't cognizable. But for the first time in 2012, the full commission voted and said, you know what, we've been wrong all these years. And those are just simply cases of sex discrimination. It just makes total sense. You can either look at them as cases of gender stereotyping, where someone's discriminating against a transgender individual because they think that this victim is transgressing sex stereotypes, or you can just look at it and say, hey, you can't discriminate against someone based on their gender identity without taking their sex into account. It's kind of like a big duh, like no-brainer. How can you discriminate against someone based on their gender identity without considering sex? And that's what the statute says. You can't discriminate on the basis of sex. So that the federal sector side, the EEOC has also been applying the same ruling on the private sector side. And we have individuals all over the country who come to us and file charges of discrimination where the private employers they think have discriminated against them, and then we have to take in those charges and do investigations. And just recently we settled a charge brought by a transgender worker out in South Dakota. So we're working it both on the private sector side and on the federal sector side. So that's the T part of LGBT. What about gay, lesbian, and bi folks? So this is evolving a little bit more slowly. Some people have said, the commission itself has not yet said this, but some people have said, well, you know, the same rationale should apply with respect to LGBT claims. How can you discriminate against somebody based on their sexual orientation without considering their sex? Because inherently, when you're talking about intentional discrimination, what's going on is you've got some kind of lack of comfort or animus against them because you think they're transgressing some kind of gender-based norm, whether that's a man should always be attracted only to women, right? That's kind of like an original stereotype. Or a man should only present or act in a really masculine kind of a way. But however you look at it, intentional discrimination against someone because they're LGB usually involves some kind of problem with someone who doesn't in some way conform to your view as the one who's discriminating your sort of gender-based stereotypes. So why shouldn't the same kind of theory apply? And therefore, why isn't all sexual orientation discrimination already prohibited by Title VII? Why do we even need ENDA? Why do we need this new federal law? Well, we're not quite there yet in the federal courts. And it's far from clear whether we're going to get there yet. And so that's why we probably do need ENDA. And I'm proud to say that for a time I worked for one of the chairs of the EEOC, a guy named Stuart Ishimaru, a few years ago. And when I was working for him, Chairman Ishimaru was the first Obama administration official to testify before Congress in support of ENDA. So obviously the administration supports ENDA. And I guess now we're going to hear a little bit about the prospects for that, what's in the bill, and whether we think that that might actually happen.
Thank you, Daniel.
Yep.
Up next is Brian Moulton from HRC. I'm sorry, did you have a question? Okay.
I'm not familiar with the U.S., but in my impression, your constitution also has some not clear words, and the call to keep a dynamic interpret the unclear words. But then for the Congress law for sex, this then the court will interpret it dynamically or will wait a new Congress law, as you mentioned, the court rejected the new definition because a lot of new bills filled. So what approach between constitutional issue and a Congress law issue?
Well, there are two different sources of law, two different sources of potential claims. There are some folks who've tried to bring constitutional claims, actually, claiming that their constitutional rights were violated because usually it's a state government or a local government has acted in a way that's discriminated against them. Usually it's an equal protection under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. And some of those have been brought with some success because the Constitution does guarantee equal protection under the laws and due process. And so you'll see some folks that bring these actions on the basis of sexual, saying that, you know, I was treated differently on an irrational basis, you know, treated differently because of my sexual orientation or because of my gender identity. In fact, one of the leading circuit court decisions in this gender identity area was actually sort of a constitutional claim. It wasn't brought under Title VII. So they're sort of different sources of legal authority. I work at the EEOC, and we only deal with the law that Congress has passed. We don't have any authority to enforce or deal at all with the constitutional issues. So I was sort of limiting my discussion to that. But, you know, we can talk about that more at length, maybe after these guys talk a little bit about ENDA, if you'd like. I don't know if that was clear, but...
Thank you. Thank you. Up next is Brian Molta from Human Rights Campaign.
Great, thank you. So I just wanted to, Daniel did a fantastic job of laying out sort of where existing law is and what the sort of shortcomings of existing law and why we need further legislation by Congress to ensure there are protections for LGBT people in employment. I would give you a little sense of the history of the bill and what its approach is, and then my friend Ian is going to talk a little bit about where we are currently on ENDA and the politics around the bill and its prospects in the current Congress. So really, ENDA is the successor to legislation that was first introduced in the mid-70s, kind of in that time that Daniel was talking about, when the case law around Title VII sex discrimination prohibition really had become ossified in a way that was not protective of LGBT people. In 1974, Bella Abzug, who was a congresswoman from New York, introduced a bill that would have amended the 1964 Civil Rights Act to include sexual orientation. And so that was a broad approach on gay rights. The Civil Rights Act is obviously broader than just employment protections. It also has protections in areas like public accommodations and in federally funded programs. So that bill was obviously in 1974 not flying through the legislative process. There was not very much support for it. We really saw this gap between that bill's introduction and the beginning of a concerted effort to advocate specifically on the question of employment discrimination when ENDA was introduced for the first time in 1994. There are a lot of reasons for that gap. Perhaps the largest one is that the focus of advocacy organizations at the federal level, starting really in the early 80s, was on the federal government's response to the AIDS epidemic, and it really changed the priorities of the movement out of a deep necessity. So we saw a long pause in the advocacy, by and large, on the federal level around employment protections, although many protections advanced in the states during that period. So for the first time, again, we had a bill that was really just focused on employment, introduced in 1994, and it was also a bill that took a slightly different tack than what the 1974 measure did, and that was to create a parallel protection under federal law to Title VII, not to change what existing federal law said, what Title VII said, not putting sexual orientation in there amongst those categories, but actually following sort of the model that Congress had followed just a few years earlier in the passage of protections for people with disabilities in employment, the Americans with Disabilities Act. So the bill that we work on now, with a few substantial revisions, but nonetheless, by and large, is the bill that we have had since 1994. So it's a long-lived effort to try and change federal law to explicitly include sexual orientation and subsequently gender identity in our federal employment protections. In the interim, we've seen some significant progress on this issue in the states. We now have 21 states that have state laws that prohibit sexual orientation discrimination in employment and in other areas potentially, and 17 states that have explicit protections for gender identity, as well as the District of Columbia. But obviously, neither of those are majority numbers, and the vast majority of the United States, there still is no explicit protection as a matter of state or federal law for LGBT people in employment. And so it's still a major issue facing our community, and that's why you see, despite the long slog that it's been to try and advance these protections, it still remains a very high priority for the community. So I want to talk a little bit about what is in ENDA, what does it do, and then I'll talk a little bit about another policy vehicle for advancing employment protections, and then pass it off to Ian to talk about sort of, that's what it is, how do we get it done. So ENDA very closely tracks the way Title VII and the Americans with Disabilities Act are structured in terms of what it prohibits and what the remedies are, what the processes are for people to seek relief under the law. But you know, the basics are that it prohibits employment decisions, including hiring, refusing to hire, firing, refusing to promote, and otherwise subjecting someone to differential treatment in the terms and conditions of their employment based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And it addresses really that ambiguity that I think you might have taken away from Daniel's description of the way the courts have looked at Title VII sex discrimination prohibition over the years, including still in a way that does not include discrimination based on sexual orientation per se, and in a number of circuits, despite all the great progress we've seen and the great work of the EEOC on this topic, in a number of circuits where there's still controlling case law that suggests that gender identity is not covered under Title VII sex discrimination prohibition. So we needed something that was quite explicit in this federal law so that there wasn't any ambiguity for courts about, well, what did Congress mean, or what is this term that's not defined as sex, what does it mean? And so the bill does include and define sexual orientation and gender identity. And I want to particularly talk about the definition of gender identity because we also want to make sure we're protecting transgender people in kind of all the aspects of ways they might experience differential treatment and employment. One of the other limitations of some of the Title VII case law that we have seen advance on gender identity is we look at particular fact patterns. It's a particular structure. There's this, male to female transsexual individual who, is seeking to remain employed, who's transitioning on the job potentially, and some questions get left unanswered about what would happen if this individual was trying to use a particular sex-segregated facility, like a restroom or a locker room, or if this individual didn't want to fully comply with a gender-based dress code in employment? There are a lot of questions that some of these cases don't answer for us because they're based on a particular individual's set of circumstances. And so the definition of gender identity is very broad, and it's defined as gender-related identity, appearance, or mannerism, or other gender-related characteristics of an individual with or without regard to the individual's designated sex at birth. So we wanted to make sure that we were sweeping in all of the different ways that someone might express their gender in the workplace and thus experience some sort of differential treatment from their employer. As Daniel said, the bill, like Title VII, only applies to employers of 15 or more employees. So we very much have worked to track existing federal law and really demonstrate that we're trying to ensure LGBT people have the same type of protections that other groups have under federal law. Similarly, the bill doesn't apply to the armed forces in the same way that Title VII does not apply to uniformed service members. The bill has an exemption for religious organizations, which I will certainly give Ian the opportunity to talk about as well. And this is one of the places in which ENDA diverts from the model of federal law. Title VII, as Daniel mentioned, prohibits religious-based discrimination and employment as well. But that law, that federal law, exempts religious entities from that prohibition. So if you're a religious organization, you can continue to make your hiring decisions based on religion. You can take religion into an account in a way that a private employer is prohibited from doing so. What we have done in ENDA is we have taken that group of religious organizations that can make religious-based decisions, and we have extended that exemption to decisions based on sexual orientation and gender identity as well. This subjects LGBT people, obviously, to a different standard than applies to people based on their sex or their race or their national origin. This is done largely out of politics, right? It's a lot of the opposition to equality for LGBT people is based in religious belief. And rather than subjecting religious employers to an inquiry every time they wanted to fire an LGBT person under this law, as whether or not they had a religious reason for doing so. The drafters of the bill and the sponsors chose to take this broad approach in which they essentially just took those religious employers off the table when it came to the application of the law. Is that the right policy? No. But it is what has been in the bill since 1994, and has been the way the supporters of the legislation in Congress have attempted to short-circuit the objection to the application of a law like this to religious entities. And I'm sure Ian can talk a little more about the very significant challenges that sort of policy approach around religious organization poses here, and as a model in other areas around LGBT equality. The bill also diverges from Title VII a little bit in a couple of other areas I want to touch on, and that is it doesn't allow what are called disparate impact claims. So Title VII, through interpretation by the courts and then subsequent changes made by Congress, allows individuals to file claims of discrimination based on race and sex and national origin, based on practices of an employer that on their face look neutral with regard to those categories. But have a disparate impact. They have a different and discriminatory impact on a particular group, such as women or racial or ethnic minorities. We don't have that sort of those sorts of claims available under ENDA. By and large, that was because many of those claims are based in the fact that we have a sense of how many people in a particular minority group are in the general population and also in the labor pool for a particular employer. And because we don't have that kind of data around LGBT people, and also those sorts of inquiries about sexual orientation and gender identity can still be raise questions about privacy. Those sorts of claims were not made available under the bill. It's also a way in which it takes remedies off the table for LGBT people that are otherwise available for other groups, and there are significant policy questions around whether or not that's the appropriate approach, but that is what we have in the legislation. And we also, unlike Title VII, ENDA explicitly bars any sort of preferential treatment or quotas based on sexual orientation or gender identity. So the sorts of what you might think of as hard affirmative action, actual requirements that there is a certain percentage of your labor force that reflects particular groups, those sorts of remedies are not available under ENDA. So, but otherwise, by and large, it's really a legislation that follows what we already have as a long-standing and successful model under of federal laws protecting other groups that historically have experienced discrimination. And then the one other policy solution that I wanted to mention has to deal with people, organizations, companies that do business with the federal government, that they provide goods and services to the federal government. Because those are companies that enter into contracts with the federal government, there is a different way in which the executive branch regulates how those companies behave. And that's through executive orders from the president that set terms regarding how companies have to behave when they're in engaged in these contracts with the government, whether that's for sort of toilet paper in a national park restroom or ballistic missiles. So the government contracts for an awful lot of things and spends an awful lot of money doing so. So this is a large number of employers and a lot of money flowing. And starting in the Johnson administration in 1965, the president issued an executive order that prohibited discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin by companies that were doing business with the federal government. There is advocacy to amend that executive order to also include sexual orientation and gender identity. that's an important avenue for us because it does reach millions of employees who work for these many companies that do business with the federal government. It's also something that the president can do without Congress having to act. And it's also another important remedy that needs to be available to people with these employers. The remedy, by and large, that's most important under the executive order is that companies that don't abide by those restrictions can be barred from doing business with the government in the future, and that's a very strong remedy that's available to the executive branch in order to ensure companies are behaving in a non-discriminatory manner. So Ian can touch on sort of how that fits into our advocacy around ENDA, but it's certainly another important policy option that we are pushing for in a way to protect at least some group of LGBT people. Obviously, it is not as robust or comprehensive a solution as ENDA, but it's still a very important piece of making federal law inclusive of LGBT people in the workplace. So I think I'll just turn it over to Ian to talk about, all right, that's a great, it's all very interesting, but you know, how, if and when and how will this all come to pass? Yes.
You mentioned about the present executive order. Does that order only have effect at that period or have been renewed by other presidents?
Wow. Good question. So the order doesn't expire at the end of a presidential term. It can be superseded by a later president. So another president could issue an executive order rescinding that or changing it in some way. But for example, the order that prohibits discrimination based on race and sex and national origin and religion was issued by President Johnson in the 60s, and it's been expanded over the years. Sex was added to it. Later, but it's never been rescinded or changed or reversed by a subsequent president. So it's still in force. It's still enforced by the Department of Labor. So it's still very much part of our law. It can be changed, just like a subsequent Congress could come along and repeal a law that you know had been passed before. But it doesn't go away at the end of a presidential term.
Any other questions for Brian? All right, well, thank you, Brian. There's definitely a lot to unpack with that. Everything that's in ENDA, so we really appreciate it. Next up is Ian, who's at the Hill every day with the ACLU, well, when the Hill is working, through the ACLU. So Ian's going to really talk about what we can really do on the ground on the legislative front to pass ENDA.
Yeah, great. So I actually wanted to pick up where Brian left off, just while the executive order is fresh in our minds from the very good overview that Brian provided. But one of the reasons that advocates feel so strongly about that executive order and its importance to LGBT people is that executive order is really needed to provide LGBT workers with the same protections that exist on the basis of race and religion and sex and the other protected categories, because we have both Title VII and we have the existing executive order, both of which do important things. And one thing that an executive order would almost certainly do that ENDA would not do is it would apply to companies that contract with the federal government of any size. There's actually been quite a bit of discussion today around the fact that ENDA applies to those businesses with 15 or more employees. The executive order, if it's modeled on what is currently in place, would apply to federal contractors of any size. And it would also open up additional and important enforcement authority for the federal government in the what's known as the Office of Federal Contract Compliance, which is part of the Department of Labor. So that's really why, in addition to the, kind of the reach that the executive order would have and the protections that it would, provide, why advocates feel so strongly about it. So, now turning to ENDA, it's very interesting. Brian did a really good overview, going back to when, the seeds of ENDA were first planted with, Bella Abza back in the mid-1970s, and, this nearly 40-year journey that we've been on to get LGBT non-discrimination protections in place. At various points over those years, there have been moments where we've seen those protections were more within reach than at other times. In the mid-90s, ENDA came within one vote, actually, in passing in the United States Senate. So where are we now? Well, this is actually a very timely conversation because just yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid announced that during the current Senate work period, which goes for 4 weeks, and the only day that they have off is actually Veterans Day, that they plan to bring ENDA to the Senate floor and consider it. And this is very historic because this will be the first time in American history that a standalone LGBT non-discrimination measure will be brought to the floor of a chamber of Congress and debated and voted on. And that's very significant. And really, I think it's very much in keeping with the tidal shift that we've seen on LGBT equality in recent years. You know, for so many years, it was often, you know, you would hear people say, well, when do you think the shift is going to occur? Well, here's a newsflash. The shift has occurred. You have all lived through the shift. Some of us have been lucky enough to be doing advocacy around these issues during this period, but you know, it's really remarkable, you know, kind of the trajectory where things are headed. We're certainly not there yet, and there's a lot of work that still remains to be done, but the trend lines are absolutely unmistakable. So, you know, it's a really exciting and promising time. So what are the prospects now that ENDA is going to be coming to the floor? Well, you know, there was a post from Greg Sargent, who writes the Plumline for the Washington Post, yesterday, where he said, you know, now that ENDA is coming to the Senate floor, this presents Republicans with a real test. I actually would phrase it slightly differently. I think it presents Republicans with an opportunity to do a real course correction on their approach to LGBT rights. I mean, and now whether they take that opportunity and actually do that remains to be seen. But it really presents them with an opportunity to do a real course correction. And I actually think that that there's some promising indications that we may be seeing that. When ENDA was considered and voted on in committee in July, it not only got the support from all of the Democrats on committee, as well as from you know, some pro-LGBT Republicans. One of the Republicans who voted for it in committee was Senator Orrin Hatch, who's a Republican from Utah, which is, you know, a very deep, I mean, they don't come any redder than Utah in terms of red states, and he was one of the members who voted for ENDA in committee. So it is, you know, unlike many proposals that are in Congress these days and being voted on, ENDA actually has quite a bit of bipartisan support. Where we're at now, of course, the Senate being the Senate, 50 votes gets you nothing. You have to operate with a supermajority of 60. So where we're at as of this morning is we have 52 Democrats who support ENDA. There are four Republicans, and once Senator-elect Cory Booker takes his seat this week, there will be 53 Democrats who support it. So that puts ENDA at 57 of the necessary 60 votes to move forward. And there are roughly 8 senators who are considered to be in play, 6 Republicans, more or less, and 2 Democrats. So we only need 3 of them to break our way in order to move and advance this very important LGBT non-discrimination bill out of the Senate. And we'll have a good indication, I think probably within the next 2 weeks, as to whether we've been able to achieve that and you know, and kind of put this important marker down. And there have been those who have said, you know, that's all fine and good, but given the, you know, kind of the politics and the dynamics in the House of Representatives, what's really to be gained by that if it goes nowhere? Well, I always think that if you can have a favorable vote and a good vote on a bill that you support, that's a good thing, no matter when it occurs and what the, you know, kind of the end prospects for it are in a given Congress. And having a vote on the floor of the United States Senate, even if it doesn't get 60 votes, let's say it only gets 57 votes, that this is, you know, we've kind of topped out at where we're going to get. That is tremendously significant. To have 57 United States senators support a fully inclusive LGBT non-discrimination bill is really remarkable. I mean, some of you may recall that, you know, several years ago there was a real question about could we ever advance a proposal like ENDA that was inclusive of the transgender community in Congress. And here, you know, it's a given. It's really, we've come to a place where it's a given that this bill will be fully LGBT inclusive. But there was recently a really interesting poll done by a Republican pollster, as it would have it, who was worked on the Romney campaign. Definitely, you know, no blue credentials with this individual. But what his poll found was, well, one of the interesting pieces is because ENDA's been around for so long, and, you know, maybe in part because of, you know, good protections that we've been able to establish using existing civil rights laws, on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, 1 out of 10 to you know, complete 100%, what do you think the percentage is of people who think that a law like ENDA is already in place? Any guesses?
Half.
About half? 8 in 10 voters already think a law like ENDA is already in place. Now, maybe that's good on some level because hopefully some of these people own businesses and are choosing not to engage in LGBT discrimination because they think it's illegal. But it has been a challenge in actually kind of advancing a proposal like ENDA when the vast majority of voters already think, what's the big deal? This is already in place. So that's been one of the challenges to overcome and, you know, kind of working to advance ENDA. But the good news is the support that exists for it. When Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid yesterday announced that the Senate was going to consider ENDA, Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, who's the chief sponsor of ENDA in the Senate, said that this is really an opportunity for our laws to catch up with where the American people are at. And that is absolutely true and in keeping with what we know to be true. This Republican poll found that 68% of registered voters supported a law like ENDA, and that includes 56% of Republicans. And the really interesting piece to come out of this poll was that in every state there was 50% plus support for protections like ENDA would provide. They range from a high, I'm happy to say, of 83% in Washington, D.C., to a low. I mean, this is the rock bottom low of 57%. Any guess on which state that is?
Florida.
It's Obama.
Arkansas, Mississippi.
All good guesses. It was actually Nebraska. But you know what? When your lowest of the low is 57%, you're doing pretty good. So, you know, the numbers like these have been very helpful in making the case for ENDA and in showing, particularly those members who are on the fence or may come and represent, you know, more conservative states, that really this is a state vote for you to cast. That, you know, this is really bringing our federal laws up to where, quite frankly, your constituents already think that they are, and when they're told that they're not, they overwhelmingly favor them. So, you know, call me a cautious optimist. I mean, I think to do this work, you have to be somewhat of a cautious optimist or, you know, kind of a glass half full kind of person. But I'm hopeful that we'll see ENDA advance out of the United States Senate in a couple weeks. I do think we stand a very good chance of getting 60 votes for this, and I actually think that there's a good possibility that Republicans may allow it to move forward without putting up a tremendous fight. Now, I don't think we'll get a majority of Republicans in the Senate who will vote for ENDA. I just don't think that we have reached that point yet. But really, where we are with Congress and kind of politics and legislatures is that while a lot of conservatives are not yet to the point of actually supporting LGBT equality, their desire to have a fight over these issues, like they very much still have that desire with respect to reproductive rights, is gone, really, on LGBT rights. Their fight is not in it. Their heart is not in it. And while they're not supportive, it's just a battle that they don't want to have. And we've already seen this play out. When ENDA had a hearing in committee, they totally disengaged. When the vote occurred this summer, none of them showed up, and actually no amendments, no kind of anti-ENDA amendments were ultimately offered. So things could certainly change on the floor. The floor is not the same as committee. And maybe we'll see a ton of, you know, kind of anti-ENDA amendments, but it would not at all surprise me, and I think the odds favor that it could get through without that happening. So we'll see, you know, fingers crossed. I wanted to speak briefly, you know, Brian touched on it and actually did a really good job of providing an overview of, you know, kind of where we're at with ENDA's religious exemption and, you know, kind of what the concerns around that are. And, you know, I don't need to go into that again because, you know, Brian did a really good job with it. But I would say that, you know, for the speaking for the ACLU as well as a number of LGBT legal organizations, we have expressed, you know, very significant concerns and opposition to ENDA's existing religious exemption because of the types of discrimination that really it would permit that we don't think should be allowed under this law. And it really, you know, puts LGBT discrimination in a different box, in a more legitimate place than our existing federal civil rights laws treat discrimination based on race and sex and disability and, you know, kind of the whole range of existing protected categories. And I think one of the interesting things is, colleague from the EEOC did a really good job talking about, you know, Title VII and kind of how we got to the place that we're at now. When the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was being debated and voted on in Congress, originally in 1964, there were efforts to broaden the religious exemption in the act beyond simply just religion to all of the categories, to give religious organizations a total out from these civil rights protections. And Congress very rightly rejected that kind of blank check in the Civil Rights Act, and it has never been put in place. And now that we've arrived at a point where we're considering these types of non-discrimination protections for LGBT people, we don't think that, you know, now is the time to reverse basically a 50-year course of civil rights history and law and put in place a kind of blank check to discriminate like this exemption would provide. And to, you know, kind of give a real concrete example about what we're talking about here, you know, you could take, there are many religiously affiliated hospitals. Probably the trend lines are that more and more hospitals are becoming religiously affiliated. The danger with something like ENDA's existing religious exemption is that, you know, a janitor at the hospital who's LGBT or a billing clerk could, you know, potentially lose their job and be left without recourse, you know, with an exemption like this. So we think it should be definitely narrowed. And fundamentally, the reason that we really feel so strongly about this is because this is really where the opposition is headed on LGBT equality. They have taken their cues completely from the battle over reproductive rights, and they're now transitioning that to LGBT equality. It's really becoming no longer feasible to argue against LGBT rights on their merits. It's no longer really acceptable to say, you know, in mixed company, that you think it's permissible that gay people should be able to be fired and lose their job. And our opponents are very smart, and they know that. Even though they still argue that, they know that. And now they're saying, okay, well, that's fine, but you have to protect religious liberty. And, you know, I think when you dig down and look at, you know, what they actually mean by religious liberty, what they actually mean is not, you know, kind of the freedom to hold anti-LGBT beliefs, but they want the quote-unquote freedom to not only hold those beliefs, but to impose them on other people, to be able to engage in discrimination. And this is really where the opposition to LGBT rights is headed, and to concede a point like that in this otherwise very historic and necessary bill, we think is unwise. And, you know, given that the focus of the Washington College of Law on, you know, international law, human rights law, it's worth mentioning that earlier this year, the European Court of Human Rights had a very important decision where they rejected just these types of claims. You know, that religious liberty essentially empowered individuals to be able to engage in otherwise impermissible LGBT discrimination. And what the European Court of Human Rights said was that's not true. That's not accurate. That is not protected religious liberty. And so that's a very favorable decision. But, you know, this is, it's interesting because, you know, we're having this discussion around the religious exemption in ENDA, and, you know, of course, other efforts to, you know, really misuse religious liberty as a license to discriminate here in the United States. But those questions and those debates are also playing out internationally as well.
I have a question. I look up that in 1998, there's a Supreme Court case called O'Kill versus some daughter of federal services, which the Supreme Court held that the Title VII bars all forms of sex discrimination, including same-sex sexual harassment. Is that, I can base on this case, that the Supreme Court will protect the same-sex sexual harassment, and based on this, can I say, LGBT can be covered in the Title VII, the sex discrimination?
So that was a critical case. That was actually an opinion written by Justice Scalia. It was a unanimous Supreme Court decision. But the issue there, while it talks about same sex, that's sort of a term of art in Title VII jurisprudence. The issue was the Supreme Court in 1986 for the first time recognized a cause of action for hostile work environment harassment, which is, of course, everyone knows is covered by Title VII and by federal employment discrimination law. You can't harass somebody at work. Most of the cases, though, involved men who were harassing women, right, with propositions, sexual propositions. After the court in 86 recognized that and said, well, of course that's clearly, if a man harasses a woman at work, he's changing the terms and conditions of her employment if the harassment's bad enough. Of course Title VII covers that. The lower courts grappled with the question of whether or not, well, is that really true? Is it sex harassment? Is it discrimination because of sex if a man harasses another man at work? Either because he's attracted to that man or just because he's trying to give that man a hard time. So the lower courts took this bewildering array of stances as to whether or not that was cognizable under Title VII. So in 1998, the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia, said, you know what? As long as the terms of the statute are met, meaning there is actual discrimination because of sex, meaning the terms and conditions of employment for the victim are changed because of the victim's sex, doesn't matter that the person perpetrating the harassment is another man. So you can have males harassing males, you can now clearly have females harassing females, and it can all be actionable under Title VII. So in light of that, and there's a very interesting and useful line in that decision where Scalia recognizes, one of the arguments against it is, well, that's not what Congress had in mind in passing Title VII and the prohibition on sex discrimination. Men, you know, engaging in horseplay with other men, especially in, you know, inherently crude workplaces like, you know, construction sites and a lot of these male-dominated workplaces. Oh, that's just teasing going on. That's the way men are, right? You hear that all the time. Of course, Congress didn't mean to make that a federal case, right? And Scalia says in there, well, you know what? May be true, but we're not ultimately interpreting what the principal concerns of our legislators were. We're concerned with what the terms of the statute are. And here the statute says you can't discriminate based on sex. So as long as the conduct meets that standard, then it's actionable. And that part in particular of the opinion has been used as sort of an argument in preceding years and basically used in support of the argument that, well, same kind of argument should hold true with respect to LGB status. So what? The Congress didn't have that in mind in 1964. The statute says you can't discriminate on the basis of sex. So if you're taking the victim's sex into account by discriminating against a gay man because you don't like the fact that he's a man who is attracted to other men, that's sex discrimination. It may not be what Congress had in mind, but it doesn't matter. It should still be called sex discrimination. So I think the short answer to your question is sort of yes. The case was not about LGBT rights per se, but it certainly, I think, has been very helpful in sort of advancing that cause under Title VII.
Thank you.
have any other questions?
No. Yeah.
I am from Jacksonville, Florida, and last year a group of citizens in Jacksonville got together and were trying to pass a city ordinance that would ban discrimination of LGBT people in the workplace. And basically, we saw this. I mean, it's a conservative city, but I was just very surprised to see that there was a huge backlash from the conservative community, and it just got very heated and, like, just very hateful. There were horrible things said and done, and it did not pass. And so I was surprised to hear that the majority of the country would support these laws, because in Jacksonville, Florida, that's just not the case. There was definitely a minority who wanted to pass these laws, and certainly people did not. We were experiencing it in real life. Like, we knew it didn't. We didn't have those protections because discrimination happens all the time. And so I'm just wondering if this is something that we're seeing a lot of in cities and towns, who are seeing maybe this change in bigger urban centers, and like seeing this backlash in smaller or more conservative areas. And I assume, like, if it does pass, it would roll back these laws, or they would no longer be in effect. But what other sort of recourse would we have? I mean, I guess there is no other recourse. I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, we were involved in Jacksonville, and so I, you know, it was unfortunate that, you know, that what happened, but I wouldn't take that to indicate that, you know, a majority isn't actually in support of the protections. You know, in any sort of debate, you know, the voices that you hear are the people who are willing to engage and expend the energy and be loud and be out there. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people think it's the right thing that these protections exist, but they don't have a particular reason that they feel they need to engage on them one way or the other. I mean, obviously being asked a question in a public opinion poll is different than, you know, calling your, you know, city councilman to tell them you support or oppose a particular issue. I think a good example of that is, you know, just a few weeks ago, we saw San Antonio, Texas pass an ordinance that prohibits discrimination in employment based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And there was, you know, ugliness, and it was difficult, but you also had, you know, council members who thought it was the right thing to do and stood their ground and voted for it. So even in really conservative places like, you know, Texas, it's these measures do advance because there are, you know, fair-minded people that want to see it happen.
Certainly couldn't undo any of these ordinances,
as Daniel said earlier, some of the state and local laws are in many ways more protective. They apply to, you know, smaller employers or apply to different you know, sorts of situations. So all of those are still really important protections, but certainly one of the most important aspects of a national law like ENDA is that there are places like Jacksonville or, you know, Jackson, Mississippi or Little Rock, Arkansas, where it's really hard to advance these sorts of protections for any number of reasons, and we need there to be one, you know, standard that provides recourse for people regardless of, you know, what part of the country they live in. We're going to keep fighting on all fronts on this, and I think you'll see them come back in Jacksonville and try to get it done again. But certainly, if we have a strong bipartisan support for the bill without the kind of nastiness that you describe, on the federal level, that also is going to help us with our, you know, momentum on state and local measures as well, because we can say, look, you know, you've got all these Republicans, you know, in Congress who were able to support a similar measure at the federal level. Of course we can get that done here for, you know, the citizens of Jacksonville or wherever.
I would just say, in advocating for these type of local, state and local protections, one of the messages that really resonates with people that you can kind of cut through some of the ugliness about is referencing the golden rule, treating others as you would want to be treated, and that's really what this proposed ordinance or law is about. That really gets through to people, and they really hear that and support that. And not only are we seeing progress even in the midst of ugliness in places in like large urban centers like San Antonio. But some of the most promising breakthroughs we've seen in recent years have been in very small towns in places like Idaho, or there's a tiny Appalachian town in Kentucky called Vicka. There's less than 400 people who live there. You would think like this is not a place where LGBT equality is going to thrive, and they've recently passed and adopted successfully, I think even unanimously, an LGBT non-discrimination ordinance in Vicka, Kentucky. So that's really, those are the places where I look for hope about kind of where the future is headed. Places like Vicka, Kentucky, and some of the small towns in a state like Idaho.
And I do want to add one more thing to that, because it's not to put like a damper on the state and local laws that are being passed at those levels, but I will say it still doesn't kind of overtake what the law that needs to happen at the federal level. The reason I'll say that is because we had a workplace discrimination story as part of our series by an officer, Michael Carney, in Massachusetts, which does have a state law. Unfortunately, he was still fired through the Massachusetts Police Department, and it took him 3 to 4 years to get his job back, and that's with a state law that protected him based on his sexual orientation. And so I'm not saying that those things will happen. I know the big thing you always hear is this floodgate of litigation. Everyone's so worried, but that's just not true. It hasn't been founded. Even when things have been happening with trans workers, that haven't been founded to happen. But I do want to keep that in mind. I do want to kind of plug that to say we do still need federal protections, even in light of us wanting to make sure that there are local ordinances and state laws that are being passed.
We have a class that's going to come in a second, so unfortunately we have to wrap it up.